Set this up. So the question is, you know, what do we know? What do we not know? And when did we know it or not know it? So if we take a history of deep earthquakes, before 1925, the question wasn't, what about deep earthquakes? The question was, what was the depth of normal earthquakes? For example, the California 1906 earthquake, there were papers that said it was near the surface. There were papers that said it had a depth of about 1,000 kilometers. And there was a paper by Turner in 1922 saying that average earthquakes were at about 150 kilometers. Some were high focus, shallower, and some were deep. Now, 1927, Kiyawadati published a paper. And if you haven't read this paper, you should. It's just a wonderful paper. But he showed that some earthquakes are crustal and some are deeper than about 400 kilometers. And now this provoked Harold Jeffries. He had actually had been provoked by Turner's paper, who said, well, it's impossible that earthquakes are deeper than about 100 kilometers. He knew about Griffith's theory that rupture was caused, stress causes cracks to open, and when the cracks line up, you get rupture. And he knew because of, Harold Jeffries knew because of isostasy that you couldn't keep cracks open beneath 100 kilometers. So that was the dilemma. There are earthquakes at least as deep as 400 kilometers, but they can't exist. So in the question then from the 1930s to 19, to somewhat later, was, well, what is the mechanism? In the 1930s, they immediately said maybe they are implosive phase transitions. They couldn't reach this in the lab with olivine, but analog materials they knew had the phase transition. But in 1932, there was a paper that showed, a very nice paper, that showed that the focal mechanism of deep earthquakes looked just like the focal mechanism of shallow earthquakes, so the double couples. And so this was the situation in 1947 when the AGU president, Leighton Adams, he wrote a paper on what are the six outstanding problems in geophysics. One of them was, what is the physical mechanism of deep earthquakes? I mean, others were magnetic field, what's the cause of mountain building, a very familiar problem. But what is the physical mechanism of deep earthquakes? And so from 1950 to 1990, the science crank was turned, and several mechanisms were proposed. There's first dehydration embrittlement, which says that, well, okay, you're opening the cracks, but the cracks can be kept open because there's water in these cracks. The water comes from hydrated ocean crust, and that dehydrates it about 100 kilometers or so. There is transformational faulting, which I use in the general sense, that says that if there is a phase transition, when the transition happens, you get small grain sizes, which are weaker, and so the cracks are filled with weak, fine-grained material. And then finally, there's shear thermal instability that says that if you have creep, that's going to be heat generated, and the heat is not dissipated, and so that at some point you get runaway melting and that. And so I would say in 1990, this is the situation, whereas in 1950, there were no mechanisms for deep earthquakes, although my colleague Emile O'Call wants to revise the idea that there is implosive transitions. He has a poster downstairs. But I will say in 1990 that the question was, which mechanism responsible, or how many mechanisms are responsible? And I congratulate my previous speakers who were prescient for anticipating that I was going to say this was a significant problem, because several people have addressed this. So, okay, ordinary earthquakes, ordinary brittle fracture isn't possible. There are three popular mechanisms. And today's objection is to call attention to some unusual deep earthquakes and to encourage considering whether these provide to the mechanism at work, or whether additional mechanisms are required. That is, for example, although it was established by 1930 that deep earthquakes did exist, it hasn't been in question since. What have we established now, and what are we in the procedure where we're just expanding the number of options we have? So I'm going to start by saying we should look at some unusual events. For example, moonquakes. When the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, they emplaced four lunar seismographs that recorded seismic signals from about 1970 to 1980. Now, before we went to the moon, scientists knew that the moon would be dead seismically. Scientists knew that there couldn't be quakes, moonquakes, because there's no subduction, there's no water, the stress is, so there couldn't be quakes on the moon. And so they would detect only meteoroids, man-made impacts from pieces of the rocket that they crashed into the moon, and thermal moon quakes. However, when they emplaced the seismometers, and for here, this is the front moon, that the diamonds are four seismograph stations. The circles are all deep moon quakes. There are also shallow moon quakes, but I won't speak about these today. In this part of the moon, they found thousands and thousands of moon quakes. Most had depths from about 700 to 1,200 kilometers. And for a cross-section of the moon where the Earth is this way, they cluster here, mostly on one side of the moon. They typically occur in nests that have between 200 and 300 deep moon quakes each. They're usually given by numbers, so these are nests 26, 18, 23, 204. And the spatial extent of the individual nests is less than a couple kilometers. It's established that these are controlled by tidal forces on the moon. Now, you might wonder, since the same side of the moon is always pointed towards the Earth, how you can have tides. But there is some motion of the moon. For example, because the moon is not in the plane of the Earth, the moon goes up and down. And so, if you're looking at the moon, the man in the moon nods yes. On the other hand, because the motion of the moon around the Earth is not a circle, it's faster in some parts and slower than other parts, so the man in the moon nods no. And so this is the draconic month, this is the anomalistic month. And so if you look at the moon, it turns out the near-Earth point is in this little square that's 6 by 7, I think, degrees. And the effect of these tidal motions will depend on where you are. So if these motions are in phase, for example, in 1972, the near-Earth point is running in roughly circular, and so you might expect it would affect these equally. But in January of 71, they're linear, and so it would affect this nest, but it wouldn't affect this nest. And finally, in July of 73, you can see it would affect this nest strongly, but not this nest. So what is the evidence that these are controlled or triggered by the tides? If you plot the anomalistic phase, this is the day of the anomalistic month, basically, versus time, you see that in nest number 204, the earthquakes always occur on pretty much the same time of the month. On the other hand, in nest number 22, this line is the draconic month, and the earthquakes always occur pretty much the same time of the draconic month. And yet in another nest, there's clearly a distinct pattern, I mean these wiggles, but it's not either the anomalistic month or the draconic month. So what does this have to do with deep earthquakes? Well, if you look at, we plot here the depth in the moon, and this is the pressure. And then that we've have this scale here with the equivalent depth in the Earth. And we have versus temperature. Well, if you look at the lunar temperature, the lunar temperature goes roughly along here. And the geotherm is sort of the top here. So you see that the in the moon and the Earth, the geotherm and the lunar, the selenotherm are approximately the same. However, of course, in subduction zones in the Earth, it's going to be somewhat colder. The deep moon quakes occur in this area from 700 to 1,200 kilometers. And where deep moon quakes occur, the pressure conditions are roughly similar to Earth at 100 to 125 kilometers. Now, there's no subduction on the moon. Conventional wisdom says the lunar interior is dry. And although it turns out anything you say about the moon is less well understood than on the Earth, but it's certainly a lot drier than on the Earth. So dehydration and embrittlement is unlikely. Transformational faulting is unlikely. So is conventional wisdom wrong? That is, that we ought to have one mechanism, or is another physical mechanism at work on the moon than on the Earth? I'd like to look at another kind of unusual event, isolated deep earthquakes. And again, we've heard some talk about this morning. Researchers usually study deep earthquakes in areas where large numbers of quakes occur, as in Tonga or Japan. If you want to sample earthquakes, you would go to deep earthquakes, you'd go where lots of them occur. You sample the distribution. However, two-thirds of all deep earthquakes greater than 300 kilometers are in Tonga. This is a cross-section of the Tonga zone. And an alternate suggestion was, let's focus, rather than sampling the distribution of earthquakes, let's sample the categories of earthquakes. And so let's focus other categories of deep earthquakes, like moonquakes. But in this case, I want to focus on isolated deep earthquakes, those that are not so much in the heavily populated Wadati Benioff zone. Now, there's a hypothesis that I'm going to state here, which is, I think, obviously true. That is, as the lithosphere warms, as it subducts, we would expect that at great depths, very large earthquakes aren't possible because smaller volumes of cold material are available to accommodate seismic rupture. So it's pretty clear why, when we go deep, that you get much smaller deep earthquakes. Now, the trouble with this hypothesis is it's completely false. That is, as we know, some of the very largest deep earthquakes occur at depths exceeding 600 kilometers, and they're highly isolated apart from nearby activity. And a famous one is the Spanish deep earthquake in 1954, which occurred at 630 kilometers depth with a magnitude of almost 8. Since 54, there have been other earthquakes there, but it's still pretty isolated. I'll speak about the Colombia deep earthquake of 1970, the Tonga-Kermadec earthquake of 2002, and the Indonesia earthquake of 2004. And there's already been some discussion of the 2015 by two authors, Keiko Kuge and Zhang Wenjun, about the 2015 earthquake. So for example, the Colombia deep earthquake of 1970, this is the South America, the subduction zones here. The earthquake was here. It had a magnitude of about 8.1. And what's fascinating about it is, as far as I can tell, there are no aftershocks. There were no foreshocks. There are no earthquakes whatsoever in the ISC or ISS catalogs within 200 kilometers. We have a place where there hadn't been earthquakes within 200 kilometers. Bang, we get a big earthquake. The biggest earthquake, I believe, in the catalog at that time. And then nothing happened since. We should ask Eraman whether the Columbia network has found earthquakes there since, but I'm unaware of them if they have. Another one that's interesting is the Indonesia earthquake of 2004. This is the Indonesian arc. Here's Borneo, here's Vietnam, Philippines. Earthquake in 2004. If you take a cross section along here, A prime, and there's this earthquake. Now, the only earthquake within 100 kilometers of the magnitude 3.9, which was at 624 kilometers depth one day later. This is a magnitude 7.3. Isolated, large, deep earthquake. And then in 2002, there was an earthquake in Tonga, which the ISC, the CMT catalog put at 699 kilometers. Now, I want to warn the audience. I tell my colleagues in geology that whenever there are two seismologists in the room and one of them mentions the depth, the other one gets up and argues that the depth is wrong. And so there's been, I'm sure there are other depths for this, but it's a very deep earthquake. It's in the Tonga, and I said it's the largest quake in the CM catalog beneath 200 kilometers depth. I just learned this morning that I need to update my CMT catalog more often, because there has been a larger one in the last 2 months. Anyway, this earthquake had one foreshock, it had one aftershock, and it occurred 7 minutes after an earthquake that was about 300 kilometers away. And so here it is, the deepest earthquake in the CMT catalog, and it's pretty much isolated. And so a question I would ask for people to think about, if we're not just sampling where all the earthquakes are, but we're trying to understand the science, is, can we identify other likely locations where future large isolated deep earthquakes occur? That is a... Okay, I want to talk about a different category of peculiar earthquakes. I'm going to talk about the deep earthquake in Wyoming, and I hear you, deep earthquakes in the large sense, that is an earthquake between 60 and 700, not in the strict sense, beneath 300. About 4 years ago, a Chinese graduate student named Wei Gan showed up in my lab, and he said he was working with me, and he had money, what could I do? He was a good fellow. But it turned out he had no experience in seismology. So first thing I said, well, you should work on isolated deep earthquakes, make a map of where all the earthquakes are to find the isolated ones. And he came back to me and he said, well, what is this earthquake? And my first question was, well, where is this earthquake? And we found out it was in Wyoming, and his first question was, where is Wyoming? But anyway, I said, well, this is almost certainly a mistake. But let's look at it carefully. So, of course, we studied it carefully, and we found out it was not a mistake. It was an earthquake at 75 kilometers depth. It had a magnitude of about 4.8. And because of various things, one could locate it fairly accurately. And again, the prescient audience, I believe there are going to be some papers later where people talk more about this earthquake. Now, this interested me not only. So we published a paper saying, yeah, okay, it is at 75 kilometers depth. When I studied deep earthquakes for my book years ago, there were a number of events that, like this, that I dismissed as probably wrong. For example, George Zant had an abstract saying there was an earthquake in Utah in 1979 that was at about the 70 or 80 kilometers depth. There are some earthquakes in China that the CMT catalog had at 60 or 70 kilometers depth. And when I wrote my book, I said most likely they are errors. This earthquake is in the area of the Laramide Orogeny, a rather peculiar terrain. In this area, China has also some unusual terrain. So what I would say now is where I was confident about this in when I wrote my book, I'm no longer confident there may be other areas where earthquakes, deep earthquakes in this sense could occur. In fact, being wrong is what science is often about. When I wrote this book, I had a wager with a former colleague and graduate student, and I said we had identified 28 regions in the world where deep earthquakes occurred, and I said we've probably found them all. There will never be any earthquakes outside this region. So I had a wager, which I wrote in this book as a footnote. Prior to 2015, if there are one or more such well-located earthquakes having a believable focal depth exceeding 60 kilometers, I will owe Scott Davis's family a fine dinner prepared in the cuisine most characteristic of the region where the largest such events occurred. And so I owe Scott Davis and his family a steak dinner. I mean, it's pretty clear. And I had to publish the paper to learn that, well, actually several, there have been several other papers. I would have had to provide the dinner in any case, but so, again, I want to ask the question, or want to focus on the question, what is the physical mechanism of deep earthquakes? This is the question they were asking in 1928. But the real question is, how many distinct physical mechanisms are at work? We keep proposing more mechanisms, and are we in the stage of the science where we keep proposing mechanisms, and we in a sense, we know less and less every year, even though we understand things better and better? Or can we actually say that no, we can exclude some mechanisms, and that, or that we can say there has to be at least three separate mechanisms? And so this is what I want to ask for discussion at this conference. So another way of saying this is that if you came to me, my career, I've had trouble focusing. There are two kinds of scientists, those who bore into questions and really go deep, and there are people who are constantly sort of promiscuous, always looking around at some other topic, and I'm the second kind. If someone came to me and said, Cliff, would you study trees? I would say, sounds like trees, they got to be interesting. And of course, the first thing you would think of is you'd go where all the trees are, you'd go to the forest. It could be, if you really want to understand trees, that it is categories of trees that are important, and that there are isolated trees that would tell you more about how trees work, or how earthquakes work, and it could be it's the moonquakes that are going to tell us about deep earthquakes, and the isolated, in studying the isolated events, that will tell us about deep earthquakes, and not necessarily the earthquakes in Tonga and Japan that have been so extraordinarily well studied. So, with that, thank you for your attention.